All right, it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. You've got a couple of more days to contact the California Fish and Game Commission and ask them to reject plans to dramatically expand bear hunting in the state of California. Every year, more than 2,000 bears are killed legally by hunters across California, and they want to increase that. So maybe 2,500 bears, or maybe even kill all the bears you can, including places like San Luis Obispo County. The agency, that's the California Department of Fish and Game, also wants to allow the use of global positioning system collars and treeing switches on dogs while they're bear hunting. A treeing switch tells the hunter when the hounds have chased a bear up a tree, and then they go away and blow it out. Fish and Game Commission will ultimately decide to accept or reject the Fish and Game Department's proposals. You're pretty much going to have to send an email to the California Fish and Game Commission. Their email address, fgc@fgc.ca.gov, and they've got to get it by March 13th. So I ain't going to give you the mailing address because that ain't going to help you any. Once again, that email, fgc@fgc.ca.gov, and let the California Fish and Game Commission know that you don't want expanded bear hunting in California. Bears just fine to have around. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign update from the field. Small numbers of buffalo have begun to appear along the north and western boundaries of Yellowstone National Park late last week. Three bull buffalo were shot by Nez Perce hunters near Gardner, Montana. The Nez Perce are hunting under treaty rights through Monday, March 15th. Another small group of buffalo have migrated past Yellowstone's North Gate entrance, but have not yet entered areas where they can be vulnerable to hunters or government actions. Along Yellowstone's western boundary, several buffalo have approached but not crossed into Montana. If and when they do enter the state, their migration corridor will carry them right past the Department of Livestock's Duck Creek Trap. So Buffalo Field Campaign patrols are keeping a close eye on the buffalo and any government activity in the area. The situation with the 88 Yellowstone buffalo currently locked away from the public on private lands by Ted Turner has not changed, although the story continues to make news. A growing number of people are coming to the understanding that they have been purposely misled by the government, the media, and compromising conservation organizations. When those 88 bison born wild within Yellowstone Park were transported to Ted Turner's ranch, the public lost all access to them. Winter was unusually mild this year, and spring has arrived early, revealing and awakening the sleeping grasses. With the greening of the earth, the buffalo will come. Last year's calves grown into dark and woolly yearlings. Bulls young and frisky, and adults, and adult and enormous elegant mothers, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, grandfathers, and grandmothers. With these families will come the pregnant buffalo who hold the gift of the next generation within them. Raise your voices loud and strong for the buffalo and tell them their story so that when they do arrive, those who mean them harm will know that the buffalo's allies are strong and growing. A summer coordinator and volunteers are needed. For the past 14 summers, Buffalo Field Campaign has staffed information tables inside Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. This public education program has always been a central part of the Buffalo Field Campaign. During the summer tabling program, we meet prospective volunteers and supporters and generate needed donations. Most importantly, we educate park visitors about the endless aggression and harassment the bison endure during the time of the year when most park visitors are not around. We are currently recruiting bright, personable, passionate people who can volunteer a minimum of 3 weeks to table in the parks. The 3-week commitment will allow you to gain a solid understanding of the bison issue. We are also looking for a person more involved in the issue in all its facets who has volunteered with the campaign for at least a month previously to spearhead and oversee our summer program. This person would need to make a full summer commitment from June through Labor Day and be able to train, lead, and organize the small to medium group of volunteers. Besides being educated and articulate on bison issues, our summer coordinator needs to be a licensed driver in good standing. If you are interested and possess the qualities described above, either a volunteer or a coordinator, please apply by sending an email to volunteer@buffalofieldcampaign.org. That's volunteer at buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign can be reached at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana. They're zip 59758. If you're going to volunteer, don't just show up. Visit their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org and then give them a call at 406-646-0070 to let them know you're coming. They really like that. And, of course, you can find out all this information and more at their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And on the front lines of climate change movement, Mike Rozelle draws a line in this story by Joshua Frank and Jeffrey St. Clair. The beard is graying, the hair is clipped military short. He is a large man, about as large as Uncle Dennis, oddly shaped like a cross between a grizzly bear and a javelina. It's Rozelle, of course, Mike Rozelle, the outside agitator. He and his fellow activists have just spread an anti-coal banner in front of a growling bulldozer in West Virginia on a cold February morning in 2009. He's in this icy and unforgiving land to oppose the brutal mining operation and will soon be arrested for trespassing. Massey Energy, the target of Rozelle's protest, is the fourth largest coal extractor in the United States, mining nearly 40 million acres or tons of coal in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Tennessee each year. That arrest, nothing new for Rozelle, who cut his teeth in direct action environmental campaigns decades earlier as one of the co-founders of Earth First, a top campaigner for Greenpeace USA, and later as the wit behind the tenacious Ruckus Society. Unlike most mainstream environmentalists, you are not likely to see Rozelle sporting a suit and lobbying Washington insiders on the intricacies of mining laws. You're more apt to see this self-proclaimed lowbagger, one who lives light on the land, works to protect it, and has few possessions to show for their hard work, engaged in direct but nonviolent confrontations with the forces of industrialization using tactics honed during the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, and his descent in West Virginia is more than justified. Mountaintops of the Appalachia region from Tennessee up to the heart of West Virginia are being ravaged by the coal industry, an industry that cares little about the welfare of communities or the land that it is chewing up and spitting out in its grotesque mining operations. Debris from mining pits often 500 feet deep produce toxic waste that is then dumped in nearby valleys, polluting the rivers and poisoning the local communities downstream. Currently, no state or federal agencies are tracking the cumulative effect of the aptly named mountaintop removal, where entire peaks are being blown apart with explosives only to expose tiny seams of the precious black rock called coal. On December 22, 2008, a coal slurry impoundment in the Tennessee Valley Authority's Kingston coal-fired power plant in Harriman, Tennessee, spilled more than 500 million, that's with an M, gallons of toxic coal ash into the Tennessee River. That epic spill is over 40 times larger than the Exxon Valdez in Alaska. Approximately 525 million gallons of black coal ash flowed into tributaries of the murky Tennessee River, the water supply for Chattanooga and millions of people living downstream in the states of Alabama and neighboring Kentucky. The true costs, environmental and social, of the spill are still not known. As a result of the ongoing destruction of this forgotten region of Appalachia, Rozelle and others affiliated with his latest group, Climate Ground Zero, have set up shop and vow not to end their actions until this mining practice has been outlawed. But the West Virginia media, long in the pockets of Big Coal, has not depicted Rozelle as a nonviolent activist who has been pushed to act because of his conscience has forced him into it. On the contrary, Rozelle is being portrayed as a potential eco-terrorist and a threat not only to jobs in the region, but to human life as well. A quick search of Rozelle's name on the internet produces pages of accusations that he will go to any length for his cause, vandalism that could put lives in danger, reported WSAZ-TV on February 11, 2009. Fox affiliate WCHS-TV8 went even further in a story they aired on the same date, stating, "Rozelle has been called an eco-terrorist by some because of his tactics. He's someone we think you should know about. Tomorrow night, don't miss the Rozelle Report, when we'll take a closer look at how this man's radical methods of protest may put lives at stake in West Virginia." But Being labeled a terrorist isn't a new accusation for Roselle, who has been at the forefront of dozens of nonviolent direct action environmental campaigns throughout the past decades. I have been arrested over 40 times in 20 states, Roselle remembers with a smirk. My longest time in jail is 4 months in South Dakota for an action on Mount Rushmore against acid rain. Even anti-environmentalist Ron Arnold, who coined the term eco-terrorist in Reason magazine in the early 1980s, came out with a statement in opposition to Roselle's terrorist label. I don't agree with him, but he's no terrorist. I've covered Roselle since 1995 and even devoted dozens of pages to his protest activities in my 1997 book, Eco-Terror, The Violent Agenda to Save Nature, said Arnold. I covered his actions to distinguish between radicals and terrorists. I say he's a radical environmentalist, not an eco-terrorist. It's not a crime to be a radical, and Roselle has never been charged with any violent crime. Despite Arnold's clear distinction between terrorism and environmentalism, Western states like Idaho and Oregon seem to disagree. Back in West Virginia, Mike Roselle sat back and conducted one of his many radio interviews by telephone. Empty beer cans were piled up in the kitchen. Roselle's rental home has become the headquarters for Climate Ground Zero. In this particular interview, Roselle spelled out his defense of the tree sitters who were attempting to halt Massey Energy's mining operations by setting up camp in their blast zone. It was an unusually busy summer for Roselle, as hundreds of boisterous activists descended on West Virginia to voice their objections to mountaintop removal. The fight has heated up so much so that even Roselle is surprised at the grassroots outpouring. There have been dozens of arrests and several major protest actions, yet Roselle is still sympathetic to the workers' concerns and shrugs off the negative media coverage as par for the course. Those who are not involved in the mining industry are almost unanimously opposed to it, and even a lot of folks who work for Massey Energy are not really happy with what they're doing, but they're kind of... Because this is one of the poorest states in the country, they don't have many choices. There are no other jobs, Mike Roselle told Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! In April 2009. I don't think there's really that much support throughout West Virginia for destroying the mountains. There is support, I think, for supporting the coal industry. The best way to maintain jobs in West Virginia is to end mountaintop removal immediately, because it employs a lot less people than underground mining. Underground mining is a lot less destructive to the environment and could be even less so if more regulations were enforced and new ones put in place. So his fight to save the mountains of Appalachia continues. Laws may attempt to deter Mike Roselle as accusations of terrorism attempt to tarnish his reputation, yet he soldiers onward and will do so until he sees an end to mountaintop removal. In the meantime, you can expect Massey Energy, in conjunction with Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia, who receives hundreds of thousands of dollars from the coal industry in his state, to do their best to outlaw the actions taken by Roselle's Climate Ground Zero campaigners, even if it means trampling over their civil rights in the process. And I have no idea what that statement means, but anyway, a little background on Mike Roselle. He's also known by the nickname Nagasaki Slim, but anyway, I've known him for a few years. Well, since 1982, to be exact. Common weed killer turns male frogs into females, in this story by Maggie Fox, the health and science editor for Thomson Reuters World Environment News, with editing by Sandra Mahler. Atrazine, one of the most commonly used and controversial weed killers, can turn male frogs into females, researchers reported. The experiment is the first to show such complete effects of atrazine, which has been known to disrupt hormones and which is one of the chief suspects in the decline of amphibians such as frogs around the world. Atrazine-exposed males were both demasculinized, that is, chemically castrated, and completely feminized as adults, Tyrone Hayes of the University of California, Berkeley, and his colleagues wrote in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The chemical has been shown to disrupt development and make frogs develop both male and female features, a process termed hermaphroditism. This study of 40 male frogs shows the process can go even further, Hayes said. Before, we knew we got fewer males than we should have, and we got hermaphrodites. Now we have clearly shown that many of these animals are sex-reversed males, Hayes said in a statement. Atrazine has caused a hormonal imbalance that has made them develop into the wrong sex in terms of their genetic constitution. Whether the effects translate to humans is far from clear. Frogs have a thin skin that can absorb chemicals easily, and they literally bathe in polluted water. The European Union banned atrazine in 2004. The finding may add pressure to the United States to more closely regulate the chemical widely used in agriculture. Approximately 80 million pounds are applied annually in the United States alone, and atrazine is the most common pesticide contaminant of ground and surface water, the researchers wrote. Atrazine can be transported more than 1,000 kilometers, that's 621 miles, from its point of application via rainfall, and as a result contaminates otherwise pristine habitats, even in remote areas where it is not used, they added, citing other researchers. In fact, more than 500,000 pounds of atrazine were precipitated in rainfall each year in the United States. Ooh, that's scary. Did you get your atrazine this winter? The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency said in October it was reviewing the health impacts of atrazine. Syngenta AG, one of several companies that makes atrazine, has long defended its safety. The company says it is one of the best study herbicides available and pointed out prior safety reviews from the EPA and the World Health Organization, among others. Hayes and colleagues collected 40 African clawed frogs, keeping them in water contaminated with 2.5 parts per billion of atrazine. That ain't a whole lot. That's like a drop in a swimming pool. EPA's current drinking water standard is 3 parts per billion. 10% of the exposed genetic males develop into functional females that copulated with unexposed males and produced viable eggs, the researchers wrote. Regardless of the mechanism, the impacts of atrazine on amphibians and on wildlife in general are potentially devastating, they wrote. The negative impacts on wild amphibians is especially concerning given that the dose examined, 2.5 parts per billion, is in the range that animals experience year-round in areas where atrazine is used, as well as within levels found in rainfall, in which levels can exceed 100 parts per billion in Midwestern United States, they added. That's scary. Ooh. What's even worse? Methane bubbles in Arctic seas are stirring warming fears in this story by Alistair Doyle, environmental correspondent, with editing by Janet Lawrence from the Thomson Reuters World Environment News Service. Large amounts of powerful greenhouse gas are bubbling up from a long frozen seabed north of Siberia, raising fears of far greater leaks that could stoke global warming, scientists have said. It was unclear, however, if the Arctic emissions of methane gas were new or had been going on unnoticed for centuries since before the Industrial Revolution of the 18th century led to wide use of fossil fuels that are blamed for climate change. The study said about 8 million tons of methane a year, equivalent to the annual total previously estimated from all the world's oceans, are seeping from vast stores long trapped under permafrost below the seabed north of Russia. Subsea permafrost is losing its ability to be an impermeable cap, Natalia Shakova, a scientist at the University of Fairbanks, Alaska, said in a statement. She co-led the study published in published in a recent edition of the journal Science, it may be Friday's. I don't remember when some of this news comes out. The experts measured levels of methane, a gas that can be released by rotting vegetation in the air and water at 5,000 sites in the East Siberian Arctic Shelf from 2003 to 2008. In some places, methane was bubbling up from the seabed. Previously, the seafloor had been considered an impermeable barrier sealing methane, Shakova said. Current methane concentrations in the Arctic are the highest in 400,000 years. No one can answer this question, she said, of whether the venting was caused by global warming or by natural factors, but a projected rise in temperatures could quicken the thaw. It's good that these emissions are documented, but you cannot say they're increasing, Martin Heimann, an expert at the Max Planck Institute for Biogeochemistry in Germany, who wrote a separate article on methane in Science, told Reuters. These leaks could have been occurring all the time since the last ice age 10,000 years ago, he said. He wrote that the release of 8 million tons of methane a year was negligible compared to global emissions of about 440 million tons. Shakova's study sounds like about 5% to me, and rising. Shakova said he said there was an urgent need to monitor the region for possible future changes since permafrost traps vast amounts of methane, the second most common greenhouse gas from human activities after carbon dioxide. Monitoring could resolve if the venting was a steady ongoing phenomenon or signals the start of a more massive release period, according to the scientists based at U.S., Russian, and Swedish research institutions. Release of just a small fraction of the methane held in the East Siberian Arctic Shelf sediments could trigger abrupt climate warming, they wrote. The shelf has sometimes been above sea level during the Earth's history when submerged temperatures rise by 12 to 17 degrees Celsius, since water is warmer than air. Over thousands of years, that may thaw submerged permafrost. About 60% of methane now comes from human activities such as landfills, cattle rearing, and rice paddies. Natural sources such as wetlands make up the rest, along with poorly understood sources such as the ocean, wildfires, or termites. Most studies about methane focus on permafrost on land, but the shelf below the Laptev, East Siberian, and Russian part of the Chukchi Sea is three times the size of Siberia's wetlands. Well, that doesn't sound promising. Moving to news from Oregon, the Gold Ray Dam removal has been backed in this story by Mark Freeman of the Mail Tribune. Efforts to remove Gold Ray Dam from the Rogue River leapt forward when a draft study unveiled Thursday revealed no new apparent environmental or economic hurdles for Jackson County to cross. The draft environmental assessment points toward the proposed $5.6 million removal this year as the most cost-effective way for the county to address fish passage woes and liability issues for the 106-year-old dam the county has owned since it was decommissioned as a power plant in 1972. Here are some of the highlights from the recently released draft environmental assessment for removing Gold Ray Dam from the Upper Rogue River or fortifying it. For $5.6 million, you could totally remove the dam and any required environmental studies. $69.7 million, that's the estimate for fortifying the dam, rebuilding the fish ladder, and reinstalling power generation equipment. Doesn't sound like a good idea to me, but for $25 million, you get those profits from the hydropower operation of the dam over a 40-year period. Doesn't quite pay back the cost of doing it. 16% relative amount of 528 acres upstream of the dam that legally qualifies as jurisdictional wetlands and 22 feet. That's the maximum drop in the Rogue's elevation at the dam site should the dam be removed. It appears from the document that dam removal may be the preferable alternative, said John Vile, the county's roads and parks director who is overseeing the project. The assessment also concludes that buttressing the dam, rebuilding the antiquated fish ladder, and restoring the project to its hydropower heyday would cost a lot of money, almost $70 billion. But doing so would not provide the fish passage or liability benefits of removing it, according to the study. It's just not indicating that it's a cost-effective solution, Vile said. That was a big unknown before this point. We hadn't done that analysis. Now we know it's not in the county's financial interest. The county has entered into a $5.6 million contract with Sladen Construction Company to study and demolish the dam should Jackson County Commissioners approve the project. Removing the dam would restore 157 miles of free-flowing Rogue River from the Coal River's hatchery to the ocean. Jackson County officials plan a March 16th public hearing on the draft as part of a 30-day comment period, but the time and location have not yet been set. All public comments will be amassed with the studies and presented to the commissioners for the ultimate decision on the dam's fate on the first or second week of April, Vile said. That would put Sladen on the timeline to begin work on the removal during the summer window when construction work can be done in streams such as the Rogue. The assessment also concludes that 16% of the 528-acre area immediately upstream of the dam is actually legally defined wetlands, and that much of the area does not contain the native plant species required for wetland status. However, the study concludes that most or all wetlands lost by the dam removal will be offset by the creation of new wetlands when the river drops as much as 22 feet once the dam has been removed. The assessment concludes that long-term monitoring of wetland loss and rejuvenation is needed. Vile said the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Oregon Department of State Lands have yet to issue a joint permit for construction, which would also include wetland mitigation requirements. The study concludes that it may take up to a decade worth of winter storms to clean the upstream area of the estimated 400,000 cubic yards of gravel, boulders, and other sediment captured at the site since the original timbered dam spanned the Rogue in 1904. The project's core funding is from a $5 million federal stimulus grant the county received last year, and the removal must be completed by the end of this year to qualify for that money. And the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has just chipped in $1 million, so it looks like they've got the money to do it. Unfortunately, Japan says it won't comply with bluefin tuna ban in this story by Yoko Nishikawa, editing by Paul Tate of the Thomson Reuters World Environment News. Japan will not comply if a total ban on international trade in Atlantic bluefin tuna is imposed, a government official was quoted as saying recently, as support grows for the unprecedented trade halt. Bluefin tuna is a highly valued fish worth $200 to $300 per kilogram. That's about $100 to $150 a pound. But stocks have depleted rapidly. It is particularly sought after in Japan, where a single fish can fetch as much as $100,000. If worse comes to worse, Japan will have no choice but to lodge its reservation, Senior Vice Minister of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries Masahiko Yamada was quoted as saying by the Kyoto News Agency. Some 175 countries are due to vote on 40 proposals at a meeting of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, in Doha, Qatar, in a meeting starting on Saturday. The proposals include whether to list bluefin tuna as endangered. Monaco has proposed protecting bluefin tuna by listing it under Appendix 1 of the CITES Treaty. A two-thirds majority is required for it to be accepted, and Japan is expected to fight hard against the ban. France and Italy have also recently reversed their opposition. The European Union's executive said that last month, Atlantic bluefin tuna should be protected from being pushed into extinction by Japanese sushi lovers. And let's turn to some biodiversity news. Friending the Pacific Fisher, the Center for Biological Diversity and its allies have sent a notice of intent to sue the Interior Department for the Fed's failure to protect the Pacific Fisher, a slender mink-related mammal native to West Coast forests. And I might say old-growth West Coast forests. Though the fisher is now reduced to just two populations in the West due to its habitat loss from logging and development, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't protected the animal, instead putting it on their list of candidates for endangered species safeguards, where it's supposed to wait for protection while progress is made on other higher priority species protections. But the service is making essentially no progress on protecting other species, thus it has no excuse for not protecting the fisher now. The center and others petitioned to protect the fisher 10 years ago, and a decade is far too long for the mammal to wait for the help it urgently needs now. And deadly soot pollution is targeted. The Center for Biological Diversity has filed notice of intent to sue the Environmental Protection Agency for failing to limit dangerous pollution from particles like soot and dust. Particulate matter, or PM10, is made up of tiny particles about 10 times tinier than the width of a human hair that can travel deep into the lungs and seriously harm human health when breathed, as well as forming regional haze that cloaks vistas in scenic places throughout the West. Particulate pollution also includes soot or black carbon, which is one of the most potent contributors to global warming. But in violation of the Clean Air Act, the EPA has failed to watchdog 5 Western states to make sure they're following laws to protect the public and the climate from particulate air pollution. This kind of pollution is dirty and dangerous, and the EPA needs to do what the law requires to get it out of the air. And a suit has been launched to stop lead poisoning of seabirds. As many as 10 Laysan albatross chicks die per, 10,000 Laysan albatross chicks die per year from lead poisoning on Midway Atoll. So the Center for Biological Diversity has filed a formal warning that they'll sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and other agencies for failing to clean up the source. Toxic lead-based paint chips are shedding from deteriorating buildings at the decommissioned military base on the island, leaving baby albatrosses, which eat the chips, with nerve damage, which results in droop wing. Unable to lift their wings, these chicks will never fly and drag their wings painfully along the ground, becoming susceptible with open sores, fractures, and a slow death. Lead poisoning from the same military base threatens the highly endangered Laysan duck and 17 other seabirds. For too long, the Fish and Wildlife Service has stood by while thousands of albatross chicks die needlessly every year, said Shea Wolf, a center biologist. If they don't take action to stop this problem, we will. And in our final story tonight, the center takes action on brutal rattlesnake roundup. Stop the indiscriminate and abhorrently legal killing of eastern diamondback rattlesnakes in the southeast. Last Thursday, the Center for Biological Diversity wrote to the governor of Georgia urging the state to outlaw rattlesnake roundups. During these annual contests, hunters bring in as many rattlesnakes as they can catch in a year, at which point the snakes are slaughtered and sold for meat and skin. A recent study shows that the roundups have a seriously depleted populations of eastern diamondback rattlesnakes in the southeast, but Georgia still holds two of these gore fests every year. Rattlesnake roundups also harm other species, since snake collectors spray gasoline into tortoise burrows to capture their prey, destroying the burrows and usually killing any other animal inside. More than 350 other wildlife species use gopher tortoise burrows, and the tortoise itself is under consideration for Endangered Species Act protection. These senseless killing contests are imperiling whole ecosystems and must be stopped, the center wrote. Roundup should be replaced with festivals to celebrate native wildlife. And for more information, visit www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for environmental news this week. Tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz or at www.freakradio.org for another Earth First update. If you'd like to download a podcast or listen to a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update, please visit the following website, www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth, and then select Earth First Radio, and we thank the folks at h2opodcast.com a whole lot for recording and archiving those shows for our listeners. Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening and tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another edition of Earth First Radio.